Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Carr Scott, a former governor, former United States senator from North Carolina, was a rural populist whose progressive politics inspired the political careers of Terry Sanford and Jim Hunt, among others. But most of us North Carolinians today, if you pressed us, couldn't tell. We might not even know who Carr Scott is. My friend and historian, Professor Emeritus at the University of Florida, but living amongst us here in Chapel Hill, is Julian Pleasant, who has taken on the writing of a biography about Governor Carr Scott. And he's in the middle of the project, and I persuaded him to come in and visit about Carr Scott and about that project. And Julian Pleasant, thanks for agreeing to do all of that. Or did you agree to do all of that? Your arm was twisted, wasn't it?
I did indeed.
Who's Carr Scott?
Carr Scott was a farmer who came from a fairly significant family. His father had been commissioner of agriculture. He was also a three-time commissioner of agriculture and ran for governor in 1948 against what was then called the North Carolina machine politics, the old Shelby dynasty, and forged one of the great political upsets in North Carolina history. And he won to a large degree because he presented a go-forward program. He saw North Carolina as falling behind in education and roads and health care. And he knew that if he could get the support of the people for changing the government to get a progressive populist movement that would help those that were not as well off as some of those who were running the state, the bankers and the owners of the textile mills. So he won a huge victory in 1948 and came in and did what he promised to do. He created some 15,000 miles of newly paved roads, almost all rural, 8,000 new classrooms, health care, aid to indigents, aid to mental health, hospital at UNC. All of these were great changes. And what he did by producing help to the rural areas through telephones, electricity, and community health care, it changed the future of America. And so Carr Scott, only the second farmer ever elected as governor, comes into this office as a change maker. He is a powerful, influential statesman, really. He cared about the people. He was not much of a politician in the sense that he wanted to do what was in his best interest. He was straightforward, honest to a fault, critical of his opponents, and as Bill Friday told me, he said he liked to stir things up.
He did.
And he did indeed, and didn't much care what people thought of his point of view. He was determined to get his program through.
He sounds like a liberal.
Well, I would characterize him as probably a pragmatic populist. For the day, 1949, the New York Times called him the most liberal governor in the South. That's not much of an achievement considering the other governors. But nonetheless, he was ahead of his day in several categories. Number one, he very early in his term as governor said, we're not going to avoid the Negro question any longer. We need to take care of these citizens of the state. So he made certain that more money was given to black education. The schools were better. Black teachers were paid the same as white teachers. And he met with the black leaders and discussed their grievances and issues, which caused quite consternation in the state. Got a lot of negative phone calls and letters about that. And he also pursued the rights of women. He understood that they had been second-class citizens as well, and one of his achievements was to appoint Susie Sharp, first female Superior Court judge in the state. He appointed Dr. Harold Trigg.
It's hard. We've read Susie Sharp's biography and been reminded that I believe Susie Sharp was maybe a Superior Court judge at a time, right about the time that finally women got to be on the juries. Women were strangers in court.
Oh, yeah. Women were hardly ever in court for any reason whatsoever except for a stenographer. And it was a pretty dramatic decision. And, of course, a lot of people in the state were very upset. Well, women can't be judges. You know, this is a terrible decision. Same thing about Trigg. You should see some of the letters. You can imagine what the letters were in 1949 by appointing Dr. Trigg to the State Board of Education. And he understood that blacks needed opportunities. Women needed the same. They need to be represented on state boards. And so his idea was, let's move forward and give everybody a chance to improve their status.
He was not burdened with the responsibility or the civil rights movement of pushing desegregation and integration. He wasn't going there. He was just opening the doors under the system of segregation to black citizens, and he wasn't really being revolutionary in terms of women's rights. He was just opening the door a little bit.
Right.
Am I characterizing that correctly?
That's right. He would probably be a moderate on race compared to other Southern governors. He never, ever promoted integration. He always believed that the segregation of the races is what both races wanted, and that ultimately the state of North Carolina, if they followed his lead, would be able to provide the opportunities for minorities that were not at that point available. So he later, when he's in the United States Senate, very much opposed to Brown v. Board. And then when the Civil Rights Act of 1957 was in the Senate, he got up and made a harsh speech against that bill, called the federal government a new generation of carpetbaggers. And it was a speech that could have been made by Strom Thurmond. Mm. And it's sometimes a little hard to reconcile his attitude toward race. As governor, he seemed to be more moderate, more willing to accept some change. Once he got in the Senate and was influenced by the Southern Bloc, Talmadge and Russell and all of those, he seemed to slip back into a much more anti-civil rights mind. And I really don't know how to explain it.
Well, I think the puzzle, the challenge for those of us who are interested in history, Southern history and North Carolina history, is to try to sort out the ideas that we have these governors, these political leaders who in one sense are the most progressive that you could conceive of being on all kinds of issues, but who accepted the Southern system of segregation and of a certain extent white domination of society apparently comfortably. And we just have a hard time saying, well, they must have known this wasn't right. They must have known this wasn't right. Why didn't they work harder to make changes? And we're scraping around trying to figure out the answer to that question.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. And you can see as governor, he was willing to take political risks at that time, which were highly unpopular in the state. But once he got in the Senate, it seems as though he was, in my view, influenced by the Southern Bloc, and he was thinking about reelection and thought that he would probably not get reelected. As you know, at the time, the governor of North Carolina in 49 could only serve one term. So it was easier to be a statesman because he was not going to run for reelection. But he always had his eye on that Senate seat.
Oh, really? He did?
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
And particularly, he appointed Frank Graham to the seat when Mel Broughton died, and that horrible, divisive 50 campaign with all the racist and anti-red rhetoric.
Tell you what, Julian Pleasant, let's take a break and then come back and talk about that appointment and the campaign that followed and how that had an impact on Carr Scott's career and on North Carolina history. Julian Pleasant is the author of an upcoming biography on Carr Scott, and he's given us an inside look on the life of that important person. He and I'll be right back. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is University of Florida Emeritus Professor of History and now resident of the Chapel Hill area. And instead of retiring, he's knuckled down to write a biography of one of North Carolina's most important political figures. I think people who study North Carolina history would agree, Julian, but we don't know too much about him now.
Well, and that's one reason I think this is an important biography. I think that the election of 1948 was a real turning point in the history of this state. Carr Scott, who had no money, very little recognition, ran against Charles Johnson, who was the candidate of the machine. No one gave Scott any chance of winning that election, but he campaigned hard. He had some good issues, and he determined that the state needed to change. It was after World War II. There were surplus funds. He thought there were not enough state services. He realized that the farmers were mired in the mud. They didn't have telephones. They didn't have electricity in many cases. A third of the farms in North Carolina in 1949 were without electricity. 72% of the North Carolina population in 1949 lived on farms or in rural areas. And so they were essentially second-class citizens. And he thought if he could get them out of the mud, give them health care, give them better schools, that the entire state would progress.
What side did the political machine, I guess you'd call it conservative, but it was on the positive side of this, this was sort of the good, regular, honest government theme.
Yes.
These guys, what did they say in response to these needs in North Carolina that many people would have agreed needed to be met? Would they just say, well, we don't want more government, we don't want to spend, what would be the response to Scott on these issues?
V.O. Key referred to these people as progressive plutocracy, and the state was essentially run by businessmen and the state bureaucracy, and they were content to move along as they had. I mean, this was not a backward state by any stretch of the imagination, but they had very little imagination. They were unwilling to raise taxes. They didn't want to spend the surplus. They were afraid there might be a recession. And if you look at the campaign strategy of both Charles Johnson and Scott, they agreed on almost every issue. But what Scott was talking about, we need to get away from basic conservative politics. We need to expand the state's educational system. We need to be better in every category. And we need to spend the surplus because there's not so much a surplus as a lack of services. And he realized the state would not progress unless you had these good roads, unless you had better schools and better health care. And so he used the farm vote and the populist view that I'm the people's candidate. I'm running against the machine. The machine has been handpicked for years. You don't want some bureaucrats and business leaders and bankers to pick your governor for you, do you?
And it sounds like sort of a Tea Party in reverse, that instead of saying we don't want government to do anything for us anymore, we don't want government doing more, as the Tea Party would say today, we need government to do something, and we need to get those guys who won't do anything for us out of office. It was a discontent. Similarly, it was discontent, but it was discontent that was rising up for an entirely different reason than the current people.
Yeah, and it's very clear in his mind, and I think having studied this, not completely, but if Johnson had come into office, the entire history of the state would be changed. because he would never have gotten the road bond issue and the school bond issue passed. There would not have been the kind of expenditure made, and Johnson wouldn't have wanted it and probably couldn't have gotten it through the legislature, which was very conservative. There was an economy block. They didn't want to spend the money, didn't want any new taxes, and it was just the way North Carolina had been run.
Well, how did Governor Scott – this is a question I had that although he was elected, the legislature was pretty much the same, and how could a progressive or a liberal governor get stuff through a conservative legislature? How did he do all this if they were still sort of the servants of the whole machine?
Well, 80% of the legislature had supported Johnson. So when he comes in with all these new ideas, and they were a little reluctant to deal with Scott because some people thought he was a little bit uncouth. You know, he was a farmer from Hall River and that he hadn't really had the kind
of... And he chewed tobacco. Of course, some of them did too, but I mean, that was a...
He chewed tobacco and had a cigar in his mouth constantly. And he kept talking about, I've got to plow to the end of the row. I'm getting behind on my hauling. You know, these kind of folksy terms. And I talked to his secretary. She said that when he used those terms, he always had a little twinkle in his eye. But what he had was a strong majority of voters. And what he did, he got on the bully pulpit. He called, for example, on a radio address for people to come to Raleigh to support his education bill. 5,000 people showed up in the auditorium, and they cheered and pressured the legislators, you guys got to get something done. Same thing with the road bond issue. And once the legislature had passed the bond issue, which would be voted on by the public, then he set up an organization, Better Schools and Roads Incorporated, put out literature, went all over the state just as if he were campaigning for office, talked to people who were in key positions, and changed the public's attitude about the bond issue. And both of them passed. The road bond issue, obviously closer than the education issue. But he also would call the legislators in his office and do what he called a little head knocking. He said, I just want you all to know that when the legislative session is over, I'm going to remember those who oppose me. And he was willing to compromise. I mean, he was a good legislator. He knew how to persuade people, and he knew how to get public opinion on his side.
Well, in Chapel Hill, maybe the thing that he's remembered most for is his appointment of Frank Graham, the president of the University of North Carolina, as a United States senator. And how it seems extraordinary that in North Carolina, a governor, even one who's tagged as being progressive or liberal, would pick the most liberal man, public figure in the state to represent North Carolina in the Senate. How did all that come about?
Well, when Mel Broughton died in March of 1949, like all circumstances, immediately people were lining up to get appointed to the seat, and people like Capus Wainick and others were coming to Raleigh, and their friends were sending letters and telegrams and phone calls. And so Scott made up a list of all those who he thought were either qualified or interested. And the list was something like 47, 48 names.
Wow.
And he was trying to figure out how to make this choice, a very difficult choice to make. And one of his aides told him, said, if you pick one person, all the other people are going to be mad. So maybe you should pick somebody who's not a politician, who's not a lawyer. And that got him to thinking about that. And he gave the list to his wife, Miss Mary. She ran her finger down the list and came to Frank Graham and said, I don't need to go any farther. That's who I think should get the position. So he began to think, what would be the impact of picking somebody like Frank Graham? It would be an extraordinary change to what North Carolina politics had been in the past. I mean, he was a university president, had no experience whatsoever in politics. So he asked Graham three times. Every time, Graham turned him down. And he sent Jonathan Daniels over to try to persuade Frank Graham. Graham didn't want to do it. Graham's wife didn't want him to do it. But finally, they prevailed on his patriotism. He was in favor of world peace and human rights, and you can do more good in Washington than you can in Chapel Hill. So he finally accepted, and it was a firestorm of protest and accolades. I don't know that I've ever seen any appointment get
the public split on it.
Absolutely. Such great praise from people all over the country. Truman thought it was a wonderful choice. But in the state of North Carolina, everybody thought he was a communist and he was a dupe of Joe Stalin. And they thought he had gone way too far on race. You know, he had been as part of the panel of civil rights to secure these rights. And they just saw him as way too radical for North Carolina.
Well, but there, I had the impression, and maybe it's just because I live in Chapel Hill and have been part of, you know, university life a lot of my life, that Frank Graham was a personal hero for many, many people throughout the state. That he was what beyond politics, he was just a beloved figure for because he was just such a good person who would remember your name, who would help you when he could, and. I don't want to make an unfair comparison with President Friday, but it was similar that each of these guys had a big fan club as throughout North Carolina based on sort of personal connections.
There's no question about it. Frank Graham was as beloved as any man in the state. The people who knew him knew what an extraordinary human being he was. And from that point of view, when he started the campaign in 1950
for him to be elected.
That's right. He was appointed in 49 and had to run in 1950. He had great advantages. He had the name recognition. He had the support of all UNC graduates. He had the News Observer. He had Carr Scott. He had the educators. He had most of the farmers. And everyone, even Scott, thought, well, he is so popular and so well-known that he will win this election without too much difficulty. And one of the problems they did not foresee is that Frank Graham was not a political person, was not a campaigner, never asked anybody to vote for him, never asked
too much of a gentleman to be involved in that game.
He was. He couldn't bring himself to raise money or to ask people to vote for him. And he never, ever answered all these vicious charges. He would not attack Willie Smith. He wouldn't get in the gutter with him. He just said, I believe in a high-minded campaign. People know me. People know what I believe in, and they'll vote for me or not.
Carr Scott brought other people into the political world, including to work on the Graham campaign, which, by the way, you've so eloquently described. But I'm interested. Terry Sanford, of course, would connect to the Scott and the Graham campaigns, and so would a guy named Locke Faircloth.
Yep.
I believe if I remember, help me, you've got, I mean, you probably, my memory's getting bad, but I believe Locke told me that Carr Scott recruited him to drive Frank Graham around.
Well, to go back a little farther, Locke said that when he was 19 or 20 working on the farm, that Carr Scott started running for governor, and Scott sort of used his connections with agriculture commissioner to get his group, and he was called to a meeting to help Carr Scott. He said when he got there, said there were two African Americans who looked lost, a drunk, a cripple, and me. And because he was the best of the lot, Carr Scott got him.
He was the county chairman, or he was.
Yeah, he was. That's right. Got him to pass out these flowers and literature, and then when 50 came, once again, he is going to join with Carr Scott supporting Frank Graham, along with Terry Sanford, who was at that time highly involved with the YDC, and another young NC State graduate named Bill Friday. And so a lot of the young, influential people in the state were on the side of Frank Graham during this 1950 campaign. Now, some of them, as we know, became more conservative as
some
time goes on.
Some became more conservative, but and that to me is the – I mean, and you describe this in your book, but I've recently talked to former Senator Robert Morgan, who was a protege of I. Beverly Lake, who later ran against Terry Sanford on a segregationist campaign. But on this election, they were for Frank Graham.
So I. Beverly Lake supported Frank Graham.
So that you have a whole at this moment during Carr Scott's governorship, you have a whole assembly of people who were important in North Carolina politics, but they didn't necessarily were working for Scott and for a progressive agenda, but they didn't necessarily continue to work in the same direction. They split.
That's right. But you know, there were so many people who cut their teeth on this campaign. Jim Hunt was another one who was a big supporter of Carr Scott. And I think that's part of Scott's legacy, that he moved this state into the progressive column and made it possible. And both Terry Sanford, when he became governor, pointed out his debt to Carr Scott. Jim Hunt, when he was governor, said that Carr Scott was our savior, that he enabled the state to move forward in a progressive manner. And of course, the state over a period of time, as Rob Christensen said in his book, Paradox of North Carolina Politics, has this dual character, a very conservative Jesse Helms and much more liberal people like Jim Hunt. But nonetheless, the state became more progressive, partly because of Scott and what he was able to accomplish in one term as governor.
We're visiting with Julian Pleasance, who is writing a biography of former Governor Carr Scott and U.S. Senator Carr Scott. Julian Pleasance, and I'll be right back. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I persuaded Julian Pleasance, emeritus professor of history from the University of Florida, but a North Carolina historian who's now in the process of writing a book about Carr Scott, governor of North Carolina, and also a United States senator. Julian, you're proving to us that Carr Scott's not only somebody we should remember, but somebody very critical in terms of the political development of the state. I'm interested, those of us who read history books, read the kinds of books that you guys write, wonder how you do it. And so talk to us about go back to the beginning. When did the idea of writing a biography of Carr Scott first enter your mind? Maybe when you were a 9-year-old or something. And then you must think about other possibilities. How did this one kind of rise to the top of the things that you'd spend a good part of your retired life working on?
Well, when I retired from Florida and moved back to Chapel Hill, I visited several people at Southern Historical and North Carolina historians and was talking with them just in general terms and learned that no one had ever written a biography of Carr Scott. Several people had started out to write one and for various reasons did not do so. And I was thinking, this guy is really important and somebody needs to chronicle his life. He was a governor and a United States senator.
Here's what I thought your answer was going to be, and then you tell me why it wasn't, why I was wrong. Because you had done this work on Frank and written about Frank Graham's Senate campaign. And of course, the whole start of that came because Carr Scott was an unusual person who made this appointment that you described earlier. And so I thought you were going to say, well, when I was writing about Frank Graham, I realized about Carr Scott and I thought, gosh, I don't have a secondary – I don't have a biography to read that I can get the answers to my questions and it needs one. And so someday I might write that. You didn't –
No, but it did help that I had done research on Carr Scott, so I knew enough about him, and I knew how important
you knew where the sources might be, or where some of the sources.
Oh, in fact, a lot of the people I interviewed for the 50 campaign are relevant, of course, to Carr Scott's career. The sources are very similar. One of the great advantages of being here is this wonderful repository at the Southern Historical, and they've got papers of Terry Sanford and Hodges and Umstead and Huey and Duke and
Raleigh. All right, so once you decided you're going to write it, did you just park yourself in the where'd you go?
Well, first thing I needed to do was look at the secondary literature just to see what was available, what had people had written, what kind of articles were out there, just to get
these are the books that people like me read,
and
not the historical stuff that people like you delve into to write the books.
Well, for example, Howard Covington's book on Terry Sanford. You know, I looked at these secondary sources just to get an idea of what was out there and what sources were available. And then what I always like to do, a lot of historians don't do this way. I sat down and read the News Observer every day for 5 years. And that way you get a sense.
Every day?
Every day.
On microfilm or what?
Yes.
How do you do this?
Every day. Now, of course, you don't read the whole
You don't
paper.
Read every ad. You read the front page and then see
Well,
what.
You read the front page. You read the editorial page. And they're columnists. And you know the News Observer has Under the Dome. And one of the great sources for this book is that Carr Scott had a press conference every Tuesday. And he was very plain-spoken, very blunt. They would ask him a question about the legislature. He said, well, that's the can't-do legislature.
Well, how would he – I'm picturing you in front of the microfilm machine, and you're rolling it over, yeah. And you get something. Do you write it down by hand? Do you have a tape recorder? What do you do to record?
You can
– Or you get a copy of that?
Yeah, you can print a copy.
Can you just press a button now on the machine and print a copy?
Put in.
And where are the News Observer archives?
Well, they're in the North Carolina collection. So that's the beginning.
That's in the Wilson Library. And so
that's right.
Even though I'm not a historian professional, I could go over there, check out that microfilm, and then if I wanted a copy, I could if I wanted to follow you around, I could
you
press
put it
and get
off.
A copy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's true almost.
I'm more likely to want to get a copy of how Carolina beat Kansas in 1950.
You can. Well, now that's one of the problems. While you're reading the newspapers, you tend to look at the NC State basketball team, and you tend to look at the headlines, and occasionally you read the comics.
I'm interested in the, now. We have all of these for modern newspapers. We have these amazing archives on electronic, available electronically. Nothing that starts in 1990 or thereabouts. Oh, yeah. Nothing before that you can use.
No, most of the stuff is available. The New York Times. That's how I did the New York Times. I just went.
That's
through.
Available electronically.
Yeah. And same thing for the Congressional Record. I went through the Congressional Record. You really just can't read the Congressional Record all the way through.
So you just type in Carr Scott and you get a pretty reliable search.
Yeah, it's not all of the things. It doesn't give you much in detail, so you have to look at each one and read that section.
I'm just thinking about what you'd miss in terms of the ads and the sports and all of these other things.
That's why I read the paper, because the Raleigh News Observer at this time was the record of North Carolina politics. They had lots of people, reporters covering the legislature, covering the governor, and you just get a sense of the time. What is going on? What's going on in the rest of the world? You know, what's happening? If we look at 1950, you pull up to Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, February 1950, McCarthy makes the Wheeling, West Virginia speech. So you see the headlines, and you see what's going on in the rest of the world. You see what's going on in the rest of the state. Now, you're focusing on Scott, but you need a context in which to place him. And it just – other people don't do it this way. I just do it because it helps me understand what's going on in a period of time that I have limited knowledge of.
We're talking with Julian Pleasance. He's writing a biography of Governor and U.S. Senator Carr Scott. We're learning how Julian approaches his work, and he and I will be right back. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Julian Pleasance. Julian Pleasance is writing a biography of Carr Scott. And thanks for sharing with us some of the things you found out about Carr Scott. But what I've gotten really interested in is how you do this. And part of it, interestingly enough, is reading the newspapers, the News and Observer, which you can do at the North Carolina Collection at Wilson Library. Anybody can go do that. You've done that. But that's not all the research you're doing. What else do you do to learn enough about Carr Scott that the rest of us didn't know so you can write it in a book that we'll buy?
Well, the other aspect, at least for me, is the documents and the private papers. And in this case, we're fortunate in that there are voluminous papers of Carr Scott as governor, also voluminous papers of his Senate career. His brother, Ralph Scott, very influential, has papers. And you really have to get back into the correspondence because publicly they're not going to always say why they did a certain thing. But in these letters, a good example would be as I was looking in the letters for 1948 campaign, and there are all kinds of letters between Carr and Ralph Scott and the black community. None of this was revealed. All of this was done sub rosa.
What are they saying to each other?
Well, they get out the black vote. T.J. Hom, who was head of the colored Oxford orphanage, they write him a letter. We need your support. We're going to send you some material that you can use. We need to get the vote out, but do it quietly. Same thing for labor. Even went so far as to bring all the labor unions together and specifically say, don't say what we're doing. We're raising money. We're getting out the vote because, again, in North Carolina, labor support could be the kiss of death. Same thing about black support. Well, if you didn't have those letters, you wouldn't know what was going on behind the scenes. So those are critical. And then congressional record and other kind of public documents from the state, speeches he made, all kinds of information that would somehow help unravel his mindset, why he decided to do certain things, what his goals were.
Do you, Julian, what about the records, the papers of his opponents and the people who hated him? And I mean, can you take time to go?
You have to. And for instance, the Umstead papers. The Umstead, they despised each other, to put it mildly. And so to go through his papers and see where he was, for example, in 1952, Umstead ran for governor. And Scott—
He was sort of running against the Scott legacy. Did Scott have a designated person?
Yeah, he supported Hubert Olive. And I think he supported him partly because he didn't want Umstead, and partly because Hubert Olive had supported Graham in 1950.
Uh-huh.
And this was really a bad decision on Scott's part because Hubert Olive was not going to win this election. But if you look at the Umstead papers, they're trying to prevent Scott from overly influencing the election. And so their process is very defensive. Same thing from almost anybody. You know, people like David Clark, who was a textile man, who hated the liberals, who hated Graham. You have to look at their papers because they're the ones who are dueling with Scott. And again, you can't understand what motivates Scott unless you know what his opposition is up to, what they're about.
How do you keep records of what you find?
Well, that's the really hard part. I've got three huge boxes, and in this case,
so you make copies.
Yes.
Is what you do.
Yes.
In the old days, the real old days, you'd had to write all this out.
Yeah.
But now you shortcut that by making copies. But then that makes for an even harder assignment when you try to sort out
It does.
Of these boxes full of copies
and
of papers that you make.
Now, technology, you take a camera, take a picture of a certain letter, you know, and then you download it in your computer and print it out. So it's a lot easier. In some cases, because of the size of the document, you need to get it printed out. So in the state archives, you just take a bunch of letters and documents you want, and they copy them for you, and then you pay for that. A lot of it you do by notes, just taking notes by hand. Sometimes
you still do that.
Yeah, well, it's easier sometimes when I'm reading a document to summarize it, and rather than copy the whole document, then again I will have to read it again when I get to that point. And this is a little easier because I can do it chronologically. So I'm now in April 1949.
Oh, really?
So as the governor,
you're not very far along yet in terms of chronologically, but you've got your arms around the project. I guess that's the main.
I've really probably done the 80-85% of the research. I'll have to do more on his Senate career, and I'll have to do a little more on the election of 1954. But I have the basic outline of what I want to do.
I'm curious about, you know, a lot of people tell historians, be sure you cover everything in your introduction and your conclusion, because a lot of people are going, that's all a lot of people. We've got a minute, less than a minute. What will be your main theme to get people in your introduction to make people think it's important to read the rest of it?
Well, I'm just going to say how important Carr Scott was to the development of the state of North Carolina, introducing progressive politics, setting the stage for Terry Sanford and Jim Hunt and others. And it had a profound impact on the state culturally, politically, economically. One of the other things he did, he developed the harbors at Wilmington and other places. You know, and he was very interested in environment. He wanted to clean up the streams and the pollution in the state. It was a very advanced concept as a Southern governor.
Well, I can't wait, Julian Pleasance. Hurry up and finish this book. You've persuaded me that it's important, and I'm real anxious to learn more about Carr Scott. Thanks for sharing with us a little bit about your methodology of historical research and writing biographies of important North Carolinians.
Thank you, DG.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. Our guest has been Julian Pleasance, who's author of an upcoming biography on Carr Scott. I'll be right back here sometime soon.